Se c'è già scuola. Where do we start?
At the end, on the way back.
Marissa and Dustin could be just a bit,
I think, do you know anything about this building? What did they tell you about what's going on?
Just briefly that Atlantic.
Yeah.
They had put in money or something.
So I'll tell you a little bit about it more just now, but anyway, so this is where the SJC has been since May.
Okay.
But SJC has been in Kaihichu since 2009.
Okay.
It was actually started in 2008. And you guys are from the...
From PPR.
Uh-huh.
Well, Sean's... Well, yes. No, that's not... Sean worked for PPR. And I volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So my day-to-day job pays all my bills as a family support worker. But I volunteer alongside Sean, on the housing campaign.
Right.
For participation in practice grants.
Okay.
Do you want to say what it is? Do you want to say what you do day-to-day?
Our organisation was established in 2006 by a woman called Enes McCormick, who was involved, heavily involved in a lot of the civil rights movement in the north, in the equality legislation and equality campaigns that came around employment, the McBride principles and all of this, and pressure on American companies about investment, being invested on the basis of equality and employment. And then in after the war and the ceasefire and the peace deal, she was involved in skewing the peace deal with equality legislation and all of that kind of stuff. So her and all many others, about 10 years afterwards, realizing that the promises and the peace deal and all of that weren't being delivered on the ground, PPR was established with a view to trying to draw a bridge between the highfalutin rights standards and the realities for people. So we organise in working class areas in Belfast and Edinburgh and Galway and Cork and around issues of travellers' rights, migrant rights, right to work, right to play, domestic violence, health, housing, so a whole range of different things using a human rights based approach. I didn't know anything about Atlantic. Atlantic Philanthropies funded our organisation at the start.
Right.
We're coming here Thursday as well. Official opening with Martin O'Brien from, you know Martin?
Yeah.
So, all those connections.
And what's the Martin, the fellowship program? Are you also involved in that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, that's how we got here and how we got to New York. Essentially, what we're trying to do, well, we're making it up as we go along a little bit, but the religious inequality aspect of housing in the north, 20 years after peace deals and all that, is still there in North Belfast. So we're pushing, you know, we developed a good campaign on housing. We can get the prayers done, we can get housing, you know, people will be housed in the better environments, but the need for additional new social housing is still a big, massive problem for Catholic families in North Belfast. That religious inequality dynamic is still there. So we're hoping to learn lessons from places across the world on housing issues, dealing with housing in tight spaces. All the stuff we've seen here is mind blown. And then apply them back home. No, we're not
looking at it. Yep. They're nice. And I'm on time.
Can I just ask, what is the PPR stand
for? Participation and practice of rights.
Of rights.
Rights.
Of rights.
So what we do is we organise rights holders and campaign to see them involved in all of the different decision-making processes that impact on their rates. So when within housing, it's fairly straightforward. You know, local housing authorities, government, health, it's a different thing. Migrant rates, different thing.
Just a question of what you guys are currently doing in South Africa, if you want to say a bit about that, so that type of, like, what are you guys doing while you're here?
Well, what are we currently doing?
Yeah.
Why we're here?
Why in South
Africa? Something similar to what we did in New York in terms of, well, here it's a very different scale in terms of looking at housing. Back when we did things like housing allocation. How long have you been in the house? Why you been so long in the house? You go on like a points-based system back home, so you go down, you present yourself as homeless, need a home, and you're awarded too many points. And whilst here, we've discovered there's no such a system. When that with people being evicted from Bromwell Street, and they told us they're on this for like 12 years plus. And we'd ask, so how do you move up this list, or what happens? You just wait. So, in New York, there was like a different scale on how you're being housed and stuff. Here, it seems to be income brackets, whatever you're earning, is where basically you're going to end up living. So it's all very different, and that's just the type of thing that we wanted to see. You know, how are people housed, or why? Why, Sean says, all these years after constitutions and promises
that
nothing's being delivered.
You can have a look at, there's an organization called Ceres, as you're going to Price Institute, and they did quite a good report a few years ago on the housing list. And said like that because
yeah.
Actually what they show is that the list, the housing waiting list is a fiction. And in fact, there is no list. It's just basically like multiple databases. There's no coherency to it anywhere in the country. So there actually is no, and in fact, what the reason why the state has pushed this idea of the list so much is because it provides them with a way to both sort of pretend as though they actually are, there's some rational way of doing this, but also they use it as a way to justify evictions and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, like we'll see the stuff, I'm sure that it's come up in Bromwell as well, where the evictions are justified on the basis, or say if there's a land invasion, on the basis of saying that those people are going to try and jump the queue of the housing waiting list. It's a very common thing that's said from the state. In fact, the report just shows that it just doesn't exist. It's very interesting. And there's also a lot of contestation that then happens over those supposed lists. And so in Lange, in a township closer to the city, there've been big conflict there over housing, because there are people who've lived in Lange for quite like a long time, who've been living in like backyard shacks in people's backyards. and then there are people in like hostels, and then there are people in new informal settlements. And what the city has done is like plays them off each other. And so the people who've been there say that they're the ones who have been on the list for longer than those people. And so why are those people getting the housing and so on and so forth? And so that sort of plays out. Just 2 weeks ago, there was quite serious like violent protest there, and they were trying to close down the highway and stuff because of this. So, yeah.
I don't know where you guys want us to start, because you could tell you briefly what you do, and then we could then
We have a bit of an idea of your organization, what we want to hear from you, what you do. what you do generally, what every day looks like, that type of thing, your perspective on this stuff. So, really, what do you?
I think just as a starting point, I mean, Kylie Jones, I'm sure you guys have been so inspired to the different types of houses that IKEA informal settlements, which is like very formal and formal areas, so much of different houses. But we were founded in 2008, and part of why we were founded was because of different organizations and different individuals at the time who were against the home violence that was happening in the country. So all these people were saying, religious leaders also part of that, to say, can we get the Western Cape government to respond appropriately, open community halls, provide humanitarian response to the victims of the home violence. So it was like South Africans saying, we are against the zone of home violence that is happening against foreign nationals. Especially black foreign nationals staying in areas like Kalimantan. But as part of that, there's a lot of, because all these movements are already working in these communities and all these individuals are already sort of doing a lot of community awareness education to say, like, but why are we so violent to other people we're staying with? But I think one of the key things on those community engagements was that people were really frustrated with the level of service delivery. You know, so many years after 1994, people still didn't have proper housing, proper employment, problems with healthcare, safety, and the huge issues. So a lot of social challenges. But also one of the other things that came out, the fact that people, especially black people, because obviously when you talk about class and race, it's unfortunately in South Africa, it's still a huge skewed across racial lines, that these people who still, in 2008, didn't have an access to a toilet, you know, not only a toilet, but accessing the toilet itself caused a lot of safety risks. So women have been raped, people have been stabbed on the way to a toilet because the toilet is at a distance from the house, because they're using communal infrastructure, where people were getting water, because we have taps, but then the water that we get is... The area around water is not hygienic, so basically, in as much as maybe getting water from the tap that is clean, you are at the same time taking a lot of diseases to the house because the areas around the taps are unhygienic. A lot of children had challenges with diarrhea, reoccurring skin rash, and so a lot of water health related issues. But another component of it was safety, and I think it came out very, very well. Probably know every time people talk about Khayelitsha or any poor township in Cape Town, there's a lot of safety concerns, right? Because all these areas have high rate of murder, high rate of contact crime, yeah. Rape is high, so there's a whole lot of those problems. But I think what we found was the fact that there was also a direct link with basic services with the safety component. And so if you address the services basic services in the first instance, you're addressing people's constitutional rights, because fortunately our constitution gives provision for everyone to receive at least basic services, which relate to dignity, to safety, to health, all these other things. And so I think we started to taking the sanitation campaign because it spoke to direct access, but at the same time, it speaks to a bigger constitutional question, you know, how we ensure that the constitutional rights are realized, but using sanitation as a lens.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, there's more resonance because it's a basic thing. It's not that people choose to use a toilet. You just use the toilet now. Like, you didn't think, you just fought. And the fact that, again, there was a lot of race linked to it, not really, a lot of class. So a lot of the people that are still affected by poor access, colored and poor black communities, but everyone who's staying in more middle class communities are not directly affected. And so there was still the fact that people felt their voices are not heard because people in areas like Cambridge have been raising some of this challenge. So there was that. That's why we focused on the sanitation campaign. I think we'll say briefly, what are we doing to actually try and advance that, right? And the second one was the safety one. And obviously, we couldn't look away from safety because safety is something all of us have everywhere, actually, in South Africa, where you can be robbed at any point.
Murray, it can be murdered, anything can happen. And so safety was one of the things we had to take. But in the beginning, we took it because it was directly linking with the basic services and constitutional rights. And so we took both these campaigns. So our work has been working on these two broad campaigns, which link in so many respects, but links with other things as well. And so as part of that work, instead of taking everything else that people in Khalid have challenges with, we work with other partners. For example, as much as we're working with health, when it comes to issues of HIV and AIDS, TB and stuff, we don't have the expertise to actually advocate and engage in that. And that is why having partnerships with organizations like Treatment Action Campaign actually make sure that people get information and access. The same thing with education. The very same people that are affected with access to sanitation and safety are the very same people who go to schools in these communities. And that's where equal education comes from. So those relationships have, or partnerships rather, have sort of added value to our struggle and you know, building on each other's victories and each other's strengths. So, yeah, I think let me pause and then we can talk about just, I don't know if we want to talk about what we doing in the sanitation campaign or how we
its genesis then. How was the initial organizing to develop a campaign? How did that start? Was there already an idea that this is an issue that must be tackled, and then it's, you know, more professional, capable organizers who begin the trend, or was it involvement of the residents of Khayelitsha and all of that? How did that take shape?
I think the fact of how we were organically established on its own speaks like volumes to how the organization then developed afterwards. Because even when we were trying to figure out what we were going to look at, it was not people sitting in an office and saying, well, this is the problem.
Yeah.
There was a lot of different community engagements that had to take place, you know, listening to the voices of the various communities that is represented. And interestingly, most of also the people that were leading those engagements are people already working in the space. Some staying in Khayelitsha, so I think that's from that organizing level. But I think one other decision that helped the movement is how we structured internally from then and now. The fact that there's always been like a grassroots, like a huge part of our structure is the grassroots movement. So we're very much present in different communities. We have different community structures, we call it branches,
right,
in different communities. And these are community members and leaders within the communities who say, this is what the SGC campaigns are going to look at, this is where we're going to go. And we, over time, we've built proper governance structures where all these people can be heard and all these people can actually contribute to the decision. So it was not immediately, okay, 1, 2, 3 is going to happen, but I think the more things go, the more you learn. And learn from home. I think we learned a lot from Treatment Action Campaign also, because they were really a social movement that was working in this space. And I think the structure of grassroots branch structure, decision-making, actually learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's
answered. That doesn't know that. It's been yeah. Where does it go from there then?
Don't talk a little bit.
It's been through like different phases, and also different strategies and tactics, and that, kind of depending on the local context, and also what was, you know, what kind of strategies were available at the time. So both campaigns have actually gone. Interestingly, both campaigns are now in court cases that have turned into litigation. The policing and criminal justice work reached court quite a bit earlier, but that ended up in a commission of inquiry, which was the Khayelitsha Commission of Inquiry into Policing, which and I'll give you these, which you can just read. You can get more detail about that stuff. But the sanitation and local government work. The heart of it has been. And this is where it comes back to the housing issues. The heart of it has been around informality and the way in which the state treats informal settlements as temporary
And so you have a situation where, say in Cape Town, 20% of households are informal, and half of Khayelitsha's is informal households as well. Most informal settlements in Cape Town have existed for like upwards of 20 years. And probably about a quarter is for more than 20 years. So you have a situation where informal settlements are actually not temporary. They've been here for a long time and they're not going anywhere, particularly with the current pace of housing delivery and urbanization. So they aren't going anywhere, but the state has treated them as temporary. So there's no long-term plans for, you know, permanent infrastructure, sanitation or otherwise. It literally is just haphazard, kind of go from one crisis to the next, that kind of thing. In housing policy, there's supposed to be, there is an upgrading the formal settlements program, which is like the formal program to upgrade settlements where they are, so that you don't have to move people. Because the idea of policy is that you're supposed to limit the amount to which people are relocated, because you don't want to disrupt communities where they are. But the reality is that program, the actual the formal program, has hardly been implemented anywhere in the country. I mean, it has been, but on a very, very small scale. That also, you know, in Cape Town, less than 5-10% of currently informal settlements are part of even planning for the informal settlements upgrade program. So it really is just a continuation, a sort of temporary in perpetuity is really the way that it is now. So it's like they're always just going to be temporary. And people can't people can't actually do anything themselves either, because the state comes and tries to prevent that. So they have something called the Anti-Land Invasion Unit, which is this unit in the state, in the city of Cape Town, which does its evictions in informal settlements or in open land. So if someone tries to like build an extension onto their home, that unit comes and demolishes it. The idea is that they're just trying to police the growth, like they don't want them to grow or change in any way. So it's kind of like people who live in informal settlements are essentially stuck in this limbo, like permanent limbo, where you can't build, you can't do, you're not moving, services aren't being provided in any in a rational, long-term way. So a lot of our work on that side has been about trying to get the state to actually see informal settlements as not temporary. And then start like planning and deliver proper infrastructure. The other part of it, which is important, which is also a little bit less kind of visible, is the other kind of the inequality of resources and institutions and stuff. So like a big push for us in the last couple of years has been on this stuff, that pamphlet, which has been around the city's budget and how financial resources are allocated. And the problem, you know, somewhere like Cape Town, I'm sure you've seen, is that Cape Town is it's an extreme, grotesque form of spatial segregation, which I don't know if this exists anywhere else to this extent. You know, and I've seen many big cities where the higher, which are sort of, you know, in terms of like income inequality and stuff, are the same, but in terms of the spatial segregation, I don't know if anything like this exists quite in the same way in anywhere else. So that presents, you know, really deep problems in terms of overcoming it. And so like we were talking about District 6, where tens of thousands of people were removed. And the reality is now that in order to deal with, you know, places like Khayelitsha, part of the response also has to be densifying the city, which is something like Mufuno Kwazi and then those guys are working on. Because it will never be solved alone by just building single unit houses 30 kilometers or 40 kilometers away from the city. And so what you see now is that across the highway in place is across from Kailicha, there's increasingly like building of houses over there because that's where there's open land. And so it's easy for the state to just go in there and build sites, small sites. But you know, it's creating, you know, wasteland communities. Yeah, so that's the kind of stuff that this campaign has been dealing with, and they're trying to build power through through evidence, through like, you know, substantive organizing on the ground. You know, a big push on that budget work was actually about getting mass submissions from residents. And making sure that like residents are fully literate in the budget, so that they can make those submissions. And then ultimately, that's now become litigation.
And that's reached, some of that's reached, that's a fusion between what the need is, what the constitution should deliver, and residents as individuals and communities not accessing it, and you providing a vehicle for them to sort of upset the apple cart a bit there and present their own submissions to pull resources down.
Yeah, so like on the one hand, in one sense, it's about disrupting power and challenging power, and doing that by going after particular institutions, and you know, preventing them from being business as usual. So like with the budget work, that was a big part of it. It's like every year the budget is just rubber stamped. The council just passes the budget and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
But then we came and we went through this mass organizing process to actually completely disrupt that.
Yeah.
And you know, go by the second year we had 3,000 informal settlement residents made submissions, which had never happened before.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do with it because it just never happened. You know, nothing like that had happened before. And so it completely disrupted that whole institution as well as the narrative of the city and the ideology in which that narrative is based. So that's the kind of like institutional power stuff. And then there's the strategic tactical, you know, like the litigation, you know, what are like the specific kind of order we want from the court. It's a combination of these things.
And how do you, that's maybe too deep into your own stuff, you want to tell, but how do you prioritize what comes when and what complements what, you know what I mean? Or is it, you know, evolving all the time and organic? Like, are you, have you got a litigation team? Have you got a organizing team? Have you got a, you know, is that the way things work? You know, how do you prioritize?
Yeah, I think at the heart of our work, more what we do is more organizing. So we work, like, our organizing, I think, is just in the school with education. So we do a lot of community education, a lot of workshops, public awareness, outdoor events to sort of raise awareness on the different issues. We do camps to engage people on issues that we wouldn't necessarily look at before. For the first time in 2014, our members, community members, actually were talking about the budget and exactly understand what is spent in Kailicha, where it sits, and it's a big document that does. And so a part of our strategy has always been to advocate and need information. And not information with selected few people, information for everyone, so that when we make these strategic decisions, everyone is on the same page. And how then litigation comes in with that, we don't just litigate for anything. It is a sort of like strategic litigation, so we use it when we try every other method. So with this citation work, with the safety work, we've tried to engage in different platforms using the law, so trying to force them outside of court using existing legislation of what is it they should provide, using protests, using the media, social media, different awareness campaign, learning other people within the state and within who have power and influence outside of the formal spaces as well. So it's a lot of that lobbying that happens. Lobbying other partners, like I said, in different parts, in as much as we're based in Cape Town, lobbying other people outside of the Western Cape from a different political context to actually talk about the very same thing. So that has sort of been part of our organizing. And then going to court has always been as a strategy. So when we found like our our work has gone to a point where we have enough, not just going to court because we want to force them, but we have gathered enough evidence, we've tried everything that we could, and therefore go to court. Internally, we don't have like a legal sort of like, department.
Yeah.
But I think part of our work and our campaigns and research, there's a lot of people with knowledge or expertise who can advise. But when we have to go to court, we make use of legal interest law firms, which have been assisting us. And mainly, we've been assisted by the Legal Resource Center, which I don't know if you know.
Yeah.
And Tifuna Ukwazi, which also has their own legal team. So we use, when we finally have to go to court, we do use public interest law firms. But internally, we do make use of advice. Of certain legislations and understanding certain legislations, and we also have researchers internally who assist with digesting all this information. But also, when we don't have the capacity to analyze some of the information, we get other organizations who have, and I think that's the beauty of the work we're in. There's other organizations who have expertise in actually analyzing all this information without having to go to court.
Yeah.
So a mixture of, but all of our work is using the law, but we're using it in different ways, not automatically going to court.
And in terms of its outcome, in terms of change, the law or everything, we tactically use the law as well. Sometimes we tactically use the law knowing that there won't be a ruling that is any good to anyone.
But we
sometimes we use the law knowing full well that it won't even reach court, but that the use of the case will open up all sorts of other doors for other reasons. For example, letting one resident push the case to such an extent that you find out the weakness in the housing association, for example, and then every resident can use whatever. Then, so we do things like that, but it's for the to map then what can you get next and what will come next. Does the law here, when you get a change, because of like the strength of the constitution and all that, does it mean change immediately, or is that that's the next stage?
I think it goes back to that when you go to court, you must know why you're going to court, what do you want. And I think for us, we've always gone to court wanting to, as much as it might be about you as an individual, but trying to address a systematic problem.
Yeah.
So that all of us don't have to go to court to address that same problem. So it has always been that strategic at that level when we finally have to go to court is sort of trying to address systematic problems. But what court judgments do when we finally get a judgment, and I think we also do have a problem sometimes, court cases do take long, but once you finally get a judgment, it provides you with like something to hold government to account to.
Yeah.
As compared to when you just say you have to do something because your moral judgment is telling you to do it. So I think it's for social movement, and for us, a lot of the things that are written down in law or judgments, they've actually given us more leverage to advocate for what we want.
I think the challenge with litigation is, like what you mentioned, it, in terms of the time it takes, is also something that is often a real challenge, because in our cases now, so we have three cases currently in the courts. One is on the policing for police, equitable police resources. The second is for the eradication of temporary services. And the third is a challenge to the constitutionality of something called the Gatherings Act, which is the legislation that governs protest in South Africa. And that the Gatherings Act one actually comes out of, it was like a slightly different thing, because it came from, we went on a civil disobedience campaign, and then people were arrested based on this law and convicted, and then the part of the defense is the constitutional challenge. So it's actually being, we're taking it on, the convictions are being taken on appeal in the higher court to then challenge the constitutionality of the law so that the convictions will fall away. But it's also an important case because it's the first case to actually challenge this law, which is a massive problem in this country and really limits the right to freedom of assembly.
Yeah.
But if you look at the time, that happened in 2013, and it's now 3 years later, and we're still in the High Court. We haven't even reached the Constitutional Court yet, so that's 3 years. And likewise, the police case was launched in March this year, and it still hasn't been heard yet. So it's going, there were various things that happened in court because we had an additional applicant who joined, but it's probably only going to be heard like next year, same as the sanitation case. So these things take years sometimes to conclude. So it can be tricky then to negotiate that with like an active campaign when you rely on that result to push things forward.
Yeah. Now that's, again, different worlds away, but there's been no case of religious discrimination been taken up against the Northern Ireland Housing Executive since it was established in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been many taken, but none have ever reached court.
Yeah.
You know, so that's part of the thing, if I was ever to try to litigate that issue, we come up against 35 years of failure to litigate, but we have tried some of that stuff. But the reason why the interest is, what change does the thing create? Because we've also had cases around, for example, the Irish language, where a judgment has come down saying that the state was at fault and must rectify the fault by committing resources to Irish language transport for children to school. But then 2.5 years later, no resources have been committed, and it needs a further campaign and to push actual resources to draw them. Do you do all of that at once? Or is it lots of different, sort of naturally, lots of different organisations and people working on different elements of all of that, or?
It's interesting you mentioned that, I think Dustin was talking about the Commission of Inquiry.
Yeah.
As part of our safety work. So we managed to force the Premier of the Western Cape to establish a Commission of Inquiry into policing and kind of should actually look at the relationship of residents to the police. That was one strategy in the campaign. And that commission did its work and it made a report. So interesting, the report, there's 20 different recommendations. So you have a document that is very progressive in terms of talking as to what needs to be done to address safety in Kailicha. Again, there's politics, obviously there's politics in any government, whether they should implement it or not. And they will always try and find every possible excuse not to. And I think what has worked for us is the sustained pressure since 2014. Every year on the 14th of, every year on the anniversary of that report, we go to the streets and remind government officials that you haven't done enough to do. But even then, we're not going out to say you haven't implemented the recommendation. We have specifically taken a few that we zoom in and say 1, 2, 3 is crucial. So we've taken 3 recommendations which we felt affect also the implementation of many other recommendations, for example, the resources one, and also looking at visible policing. And then we said, these are the ones we're going to look at, and youth and gangs. These are the ones we're going to look at, in as much as there's 20 of them, but we will focus on our campaign on the 3, so that we put pressure. Because unless you do that, they can easily brush away the emphasis, we're doing something, but you don't know what we're doing. But then when we're very specific that in terms of recommendation, we need police resources, we need to allocate police resources accordingly. They have to respond and say, this is how we allocate police resources, this is where our police resources are deployed, this is a formula we're using. So you force them to actually respond, and then you force the relevant stakeholder, and that's what we did. Instead of speaking to local police or to the Premier, we know when it comes to anything that has to do with resource allocation, they have no power. So we target the National Minister of Police, which we know is the only person who has the power to to run into the system. And so that's where our campaign is focused in. And at the same time, where the Premier of the Western Cape has the power to do something or develop a strategy to deal with youth and gang violence, we target the same pressure to her. And so we have all these parallel public campaigns on both to actually force them to do something. Because what we found is that when we try to do everything, we can easily be lost in.
Yeah. It's been a place.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. On the end of, you said the people themselves, so this is a reality anyway, as long as these cases go and campaigns go and all that. Have there been any attempts, obviously individually, people are building their own homes or building extensions on the site, and then the state's response has been to knock them down again, is that right?
Yeah.
Is there any sort of larger scale do-it-yourself type stuff where people are exposing the state by taking on the responsibilities, or are there any resources to that? Is there anything like that?
There's not, I mean, there's on a small scale, there are a couple of organizations. There's like Informal Settlement Network. There's a sort of like group of organizations. There's Informal Settlement Network, Slum Dwellers International, and Cork Community Organization Resource Center. And they do informal settlement upgrading, or what they call reblocking. They work on this model of like very much community driven development, where the state puts in some resources, but that the community drives the project. The problem is that, you know, again, it's just never really gone to scale. So they have a couple of projects, but what's really happened, in my view, is that the city of Cape Town has just used them as a smokescreen for what it's not really doing. It hasn't really, you know, it just hasn't gone to scale, you know, so.
And do they have, by the way, let us know when you've run out of time here, because I know we've kept this. Are there acceptable structures of engagement with the state, so community housing forums and this and that? And they are community-based, but for a lot of it, they're compromised, you know, for state-funded, they're compromised in a lot of different ways. Maybe just people who've been sitting on committees for 40 years and that type of stuff. Is there friction at the organising level between those two different types of activism? Do you know what I mean? Do you know, like, established, acceptable.
Yeah, I think it goes with, which is an interesting point about funding, and I think this is one thing we also need to say, that is SGC, and Atlantic also has funded us before. And SGC doesn't take money from any political party because it affects how we do advocacy work.
Yeah.
And I think that's a principle we've always held. And Christian, you know, sort of take into account that when political parties give money, they have a reason, right? But we've tried to use the formal structures established. For example, with safety, there are community policing forums that are established in all different communities, and that is legislated, and they're in constitution, they're funded by government, but again, they compromise politically and in terms of what it is they should be doing. So they're not necessarily representing the community, which they should represent. They're representing the state, which is the police. And the interesting thing is that communities are not stupid. They are the very same people who speak about these issues. And so they've questioned a lot of CPFs who are not functioning at different structures and engaged them. And so there is that problem. But I think, for example, in Khayelitsha, they are dysfunctional. Like, the voice of CPFs when it comes to safety is not there. But when it comes to political issues that are affecting the police, it's heard. And I think the communities, and I think when we engage in the next steps, people know these things. Like, these are leaders within their own communities, and they have a reputation, and that's the beauty of it. But I think for us, we've always tried to respect all the formal spaces established in terms of the constitution. We don't disregard them to say they don't exist, they're not dysfunctional, and therefore they shouldn't be considered. It's not just the SGC's call to say that. But at the same time, we can't just take them as, we need to be critical in terms of what we think they should be doing and how, and allow that dialogue to happen. And I think, I know now with the SAIT, our sanitation work, we're trying to engage with other structures that should engage the community, which is the ward committees. So part of what we're doing, we know they're dysfunctional because we've been sitting in all of them and trying to observe what's happening. But the strategy we've taken is to actually go around the community and educate communities on what the ward committees should be doing, how they should be doing it, and how communities should be involved and how they should participate. And hoping by that, communities are going to be empowered to actually participate in those, you know, substitute all those people who are there for political reasons. We don't know if it's going to work, but for us, we always feel like education or empowerment is or educating ourselves is one way of ensuring that we try to address these problems. So I know like next week there's 6 different workshops going on to try and get communities to really be aware, because there should be community representatives in these platforms, but there's none.
Yeah.
So I think we're trying to create that awareness, expanding that awareness component of our work, so that we get community members to really participate in this.
Okay. How are we for time? Are we okay? Or...
Yeah, it's 22:04.
As long as you're okay, I'm going to keep rattling here, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I recognize a couple of it. It seems that you operate. Exist in a fairly dangerous environment, like a potentially dangerous environment, and that the activism, particularly if it's civil disobedience, is dangerous. We need to go into jail, or maybe lead to worse. How do you guys make calls on what tactics to deploy and when, and what's the right thing to do with 1,000 families moving in a direction, and what's the right thing to do at any given time on that? A hard one?
No, it's not a hard one. But I think subconsciously as an activist you sort of have to accept that you are unsafe just by because you're speaking against powers that are beyond you. But obviously it does mean you need to be reckless in terms of how you do your work. But look, we are working on issues that affect all of us directly by staying in Kalichi already unsafe. So because you're unsafe for said going in a certain community, I think for us we've never thought of we're actually more motivated to actually do the work. But there have been challenges. We've had some of our comrades really affected by the work that we're doing. Framed for murder. Put to jail, harassed by the police. Rumors that the intelligence is also involved. Went to Portsmouth, convicted of murder. So we have those scenarios, which I think South Africa, in a way, maybe we're still privileged that activists are not as treated. Because I've heard in other African countries of how activists are really raped, murdered. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but maybe the environment still allows us. But obviously, I think by being in South Africa, you are safe. You do.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also had some, the previous offices that we were in, we were there for a year. And before that, we were in another office in Khayelitsha, which over a period of about 6 months, there were repeated burglaries and ransacking of the office, which seemed to be quite targeted, and it was coinciding with a lot of work we were doing around the police. Until eventually, at the end of 2014, it was ransacked and completely, the places were basically just destroyed. And so we had to take what was left, and we vacated, and then we didn't have offices for a few months, and so on, until we found this other place, which was a very very small place in Khayelitsha, just to get by before we moved here. So we were there for a year. So Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, and in fact,
and also Iranians,
So there have been, and then there was a time, during the heightened staff around the police, where police would arrive at like a private meeting. So we would be having a meeting like this, and then all of a sudden, outside, there'd be like four police tanks and a bunch of police cars and armed, you know, a lot of armed police. The last time I remember they did that was when we had a partners meeting in relation to the Commission of Inquiry. And then they would come and use that as a way to try and sort of intimidate us and so on. And I remember that particular one actually where we went out and spoke to them and they pretended as though they'd got some intelligence that the Premier was going to be there as a protest or something. And so what they did when they saw it, when we told them, well, that's not happening, most of them then left, except they went and parked one of their tanks, just like one block away, so you could see them. And then they stayed there for the whole meeting. This stuff happens. And I think it's getting worse. I think it's definitely not right. I mean, just generally, the context on this other stuff, I think it's getting worse. It's happening.
There may be negative changes that you see because of your activism, or negative reactions by the state or by powerful forces.
Mm-hmm.
What positive ones, if any, do you see?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing with the policing work has been that on the one hand, there's this resistance from, because it's kind of complex because there's the different layers of that we're dealing with. So on the one hand, the national minister has resisted and, you know, been resistant, etc. But then a lot of the implementation of the recommendations of the commission also require local police to do certain things. And at the local level, there's been like really much deeper cooperation since the commission. And so the commission brought about a change management process at the local level, which led to the local leadership, you know, building relationships with the SJC and other community organizations, trying to actually implement part of the recommendations, etc. So at the local level and the police, has actually been good stuff that's happened, and very positive.
Replicated with the sanitation issue?
No, so I mean, this sanitation is different because there we're dealing just with local government.
Yeah.
And the city has been, for a number of years now, has been highly antagonistic towards us. To the point where it's very, very difficult. Like, you know, and they're very responsive. So, you know, if you say one, put out one statement, and they go all out and attack us and try and discredit us and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you do see certain things shift, you know. So if you look at Khayelitsha as a whole, and this is something we're actually talking about, looking at how to measure some of these things, they're very hard to do that. But if you look at Khayelitsha as a whole, and you look at the sanitation situation, there actually have been a lot of improvements over the last few years. And there has been a lot more infrastructure built and so on and so forth. Which it's difficult to see how that could have happened without that sustained pressure constantly pushing. And so it's not always that simple as did you get a court order in your favor?
Yeah.
Politics just doesn't always work as simply as that. And so, you know, if we were, say, a public interest law firm, then probably that's more, you know, then you can think in those terms. But in these terms, it's much messier than that. So, yeah, I mean, part of the part of that pressure, I think, also results in the state acting in particular ways, which then also actually can, you know, in this case, I think it can actually, it has helped in terms of the actual substantive, like, delivery on the ground. It hasn't helped. It hasn't helped in the sense in terms of changing the formal policy position, which is something that the court is now hopefully going to be able to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there? I don't know, I can't think of anything else to ask. You guys think of interrogate the life out of this?
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of gather. And then.
One bit humorous.
And then also, we produced a guide to the Commission of Inquiry with Nipun Kwazi, which is quite good. I
don't
know
if you've
seen that.
No.
Oh, that would be good.
I mean,
we might actually have a hard copy here.
Just on the safety, just for
yeah.
Well, we're hoping without putting news on any big pressures to make a bit of a link now, where we can ask some questions over time about things, or I mean, those campaigns that you've laid out and the stages of development within them. You're obviously working very hard on them, but from time to time we wouldn't mind probably see a lot of it on your website. But if we could keep a bit of a relationship, if
yes, all,
you know, that type of thing, and ask questions about how it's evolving. I can see a lot of our stuff, the trends in our stuff, in your stuff, and our situations in yours. Scale and conditions are just worlds apart.
Yeah.
But I can see, you know, even that the city responds by fixing all the balconies on the high rise flats, which isn't what people want. You know, but they invest money because they have to be seen to be doing things. But those are improvements that people get where we're working. So I can see, you know, all of those things, and it'd be really interesting. Just
yeah, in fact, I went away for. I was on a 2-month writing sabbatical this year, and I've written a piece about this campaign, about the sanitation budget campaign, looking at the story of the campaign and strategies and tactics and politics of it, and you know, it's a kind of deep reflection on what happened and why and all that sorts of stuff. So. It's not finished. I emailed the second draft last night. My deadline is for people who I'm doing it with, who funded it, is actually the end of October. So we're aiming for that. I don't know if it's going to happen. But I can also send that to you once it's done, because it will have a lot more detail.
Thank you.
Let me see if there's a commission.
So how long must you have done all these different engagements until
when?
You're
part
of the fellowship, right?
Yep.
And we're supposed to be
finished
for 2 years.
Within a year. Within 1 year of starting, finishes. But I'm sure we could.
Oh,
you're
supposed to finish in June.
No, we started in June. Technically, we started in June. We got the go ahead. We got the thumbs up. You've got this fellowship.
Wow. And how are you finding it?
It's been
intense.
Yeah. This part has been intense. We went from being awarded the fellowship to having to research, find, link with, and develop visits and hit the ground.
But it's structured.
Within 2 months.
And we haven't done 2 trips. So New York was at the start of September for 10 days, back and in here.
And then once you, from here, you guys are going back home.
Back home.
And you write up.
To write up. All
write
up
the initials for the findings, generally, the throw in the net findings. And then.
Come back.
Hopefully come back. See you guys instead of everybody else. That's the other bit. hopefully come back to see.
What are the key things that you guys are looking at? Are you focusing on the strategy part, or are you just looking at anything you can take back to?
Well, for now, it's kind of like as much as we can absorb.
Okay.
And then when we get back, well, that's not it.
But really, I mean, really what it's about understanding is how within environments which may have very positive political or constitutional or rights frameworks, how activism is either performing well and pushing things well and making real change, or how that's not happening, and why, you know, that's massive, you know, that's massive stuff. But we want to particularly apply it to our own cities, and the housing campaign that we've been involved in for 10 years has got everybody on board. United Nations, European Commissioner, 49 MLAs at the Assembly, half the political establishment, the housing authorities, the housing builders, everyone and anyone. The campaign has been effective in pulling them to a position saying, oh yes, we must tackle religious inequality in housing, and oh yes, we must build on need and blah blah blah. But no bricks and mortar are hitting the ground. No policies and finances are emerging from this consensus, and that's part of our thing, and it's a challenge. And I suppose the end of apartheid was massive. The energy and everything that came with it was enormous. And now 20 years later, it's about understanding a bit of, well, why did all of that energy and positivity and capacity and then standards, why did that not translate into mass meaningful change on the ground? Which is a tough enough one.
Well, that's what everyone is asking
for about 50 pence.
Everybody wants to know.
Yeah, that's what everybody wants to know. That's what the students want to know. That's what.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you the same issue? I can't come. So we're trying to figure it out our things.
Yeah, it depends who you ask. Yeah.
Well, if we asked you, what would you say?
I don't know. I think for me, in like the urban environment, the biggest thing has been the inability to think through what it would be required to change the spatial segregation and spatial apartheid. And I don't know. It seems like policy-wise, there was just this push to produce as much housing as possible on the outskirts, because that's the easiest place to do it. But I mean, it's such a difficult thing. There's so many, I don't know what the answer is. There's so many moving parts. You know, there's like the kinds of economic policies that were adopted in the mid-90s. There's the international environment in terms of why those things were adopted. Why we went into this quite, you know, conservative economic environment. There's the inability of, I think, of white people in South Africa to move to challenge white wealth privilege. There's like all these different things which have coalesced into, I think, what we have. I don't know. Do you have an answer? I mean, I think it would be like a whole unpack it. There's so many things that you'd have to unpack.
Well, we're gonna figure all that out in 1 year.
Okay, and you'll see it as you said. Yeah, big guys sort up the
Okay.
Thanks a million for answering our questions. And hopefully we can stay in touch.
Yeah.
And we'll be back here on Thursday. Maybe we'll see you.
Yeah, we'll be here. Yeah.
What's happening then? Is it a whole ceremony or?
Yeah, it's like a ribbon cutting, screaming. Yeah.
Cheers.
It's like a 2-3 hour ceremony. Just talking about the building, the name, the people.
Okay.
And telling everyone that this is where we are now, and I think it'll also give time for people to actually look around and see the building, so you can tell them we actually been here.
We've been here.
And will it be a community effort? Will people come? Or
it's a mixture. So because a lot of the organizations are working with communities in the UK, so we've invited our branch members and the other organizations that EU have invited, the vendors. But obviously the vendors might be at school, maybe parents. So different people have an opportunity to invite different people. And obviously there's the delegates from the Atlantic and other people supporting our work, our families and partners. So
cool.
It's gonna be nice.
Okay, I'm forwarded. All right, is there anything you need to ask us or want to ask us about anything?
No.
Wrap up. Okay, thanks a minute.
Okay.
This is the